Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Morrow. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Kim Nichols of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital to discuss the incidence, prognosis, treatment, and ongoing research efforts in von Hippel-Lindau disease. VHL disease is defined as a rare inherited disorder that causes tumors and cysts to grow in specific areas of the body, including the brain, spinal cord, eyes, inner ear, adrenal glands, pancreas, kidney, and reproductive tract. Although many of these cases are benign, others can develop malignant tumors. Patients with VHL are also at an increased risk of presenting with rare types of tumors, including hemangioblastoma and pheochromocytomas. However, those with VHL syndrome also are at an increased risk of certain types of other cancers, such as clear cell renal cell carcinoma and neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas. Approximately 70% of patients with VHL end up developing RCC by the age of 60 years, and it is the leading cause of death. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Nichols discussed VHL in great detail, how she currently approaches treatment with these patients, and the importance of routine surveillance in this population. I thought that we could just first start it off by talking to me about VHL syndrome and how common is it in pediatrics? How does it present? And are there any kind of diagnostic challenges to it?
VHL syndrome is a relatively rare genetic syndrome. It's thought to affect about one in every 35 to 36,000 individuals. And this, of course, includes adults as well as children. In the United States, there probably are around about 10,000 people with VHL syndrome. And I think around the world, about 200,000. So not very many, as you can appreciate. And, you know, the thing about VHL that is challenging and at the same time very fascinating is that patients who have the condition are at increased risk for developing a variety of different tumor types. And these tend to be really rare kinds of tumors. Patients are at increased risk for presenting with tumors called hemangioblastomas. So these are generally benign tumors of blood vessels that can develop in different parts of the brain or in the back of the eye, the retina. So this tends to be one of the more common forms of tumors that you can see in patients with von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And these can occur in children. So they can occur at any time during the life course of an individual, from patients as young as, you know, infancy to toddlerhood, all the way up into the, you know, older years. Other tumor types that you can see are commonly, you know, cancers of the kidney. So renal cell carcinoma, particularly renal cell carcinoma of the clear cell type. So this is a cancer that does not usually present in children. It's generally more in the adult years, but it is one of the more common and more problematic tumor types that you can see in VHL. And then there's a whole range of other tumor types, including neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas. So these are benign. Tumors of the adrenal gland, known as pheochromocytomas, usually benign, but sometimes more aggressive. And so a whole variety of relatively rare cancers.
What would you describe as the prognosis for these patients in the pediatric population? And what are the currently available treatments for them?
That's a really, really good question. So prognosis for VHL, especially during childhood, you know, is excellent. And I think one of the things that's really, really important is surveillance. So the concept of surveillance. So when you think about the tumors that develop in VHL, with the exception of the renal cell cancers and, you know, rare cases of, for example, neuroendocrine tumors or adrenal tumors, by and large, these are benign tumors. So in and of themselves, they're not necessarily going to spread to other parts of the body and cause increased mortality that way. But these tumors can slowly grow and they can impinge on the organs either in which they're embedded or the organs that are next to them. And so they can cause problems that way. For example, there's a rare tumor type called an endolymphatic sac tumor. This is a benign tumor in the, you know, portion of the ear that helps you to hear. And these tumors can be very small, but if they press, you know, on the auditory nerves in the wrong way, you know, you can end up with deafness. So prognosis from, you know, a life expectancy perspective is very good, but you have to be very careful about organ dysfunction due to the presence of these tumors. So what's really important, and this is circling back, is the concept of surveillance, which is really monitoring for tumors with the aim, you know, not to prevent them, but to pick them up at their earliest stages, right? When they're the smallest possible lesions, and then to try to intervene in cases where you think that these could cause organ damage or organ dysfunction. So I think with really careful surveillance and appropriate intervention at the right times, you know, children should have an excellent prognosis, despite the fact that they have VHL. I mean, there are drugs on the horizon. One of the things about VHL that is, you know, really fascinating is the underlying biology of the disease. So VHL, of course, is a gene. Genes encode for proteins, and proteins are really the workhorses of the body, right? They carry out all the various bodily functions. And the protein that's encoded by the VHL gene is a really important protein that regulates how the cells of the body sense oxygen. And the kind of underlying mechanisms of how the VHL protein works has been really unraveled over the last couple decades. Really, that's what led to the awarding of the Nobel Prize, right, in 2019 to Bill Kaelin and Peter Ratcliffe and Greg Semenza. But there are now drugs, right? There are drugs. There's a drug by Merck, MK-6482, I think it is. It's a drug that, you know, interferes with the pathway that's perturbed in patients with VHL. And that drug, I think, recently achieved FDA breakthrough recognition in, you know, summer 2020 for treating adults with renal cell carcinoma that is either in the setting of patients with VHL syndrome or renal cell carcinomas that have abnormalities in kind of the VHL pathway. But I think right now for kids, mostly we monitor. We try to pick up tumors at the earliest and smallest and most successfully treatable stages. In the future, maybe we will have medications like this one where we can even prevent the tumors from occurring. So that's my goal. But anyway, prognosis is excellent, especially with surveillance.
No, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. And so if there's nothing available right now, what are some of those current intervention strategies that you are doing once it is detected? How are you best managing those patients?
So most of the time, the treatment for these tumors is surgical. So if you have one of these blood vessel tumors, like a hemangioblastoma, perhaps in the back of the eye, you know, the eye doctors can do not surgery per se, but they can do laser therapy or cryo or heat therapy to the small tumors. If you have one of these tumors that's maybe in the brain or the spinal cord and it's causing troubles, patients have symptoms, usually it's surgery. And actually, it's pretty precise, you know, microsurgery to try to remove these tumors really carefully and not cause any damage to the surrounding brain or spinal cord. But generally speaking, surgical intervention is what is needed. So patients with VHL, you know, unfortunately, do have to undergo procedures periodically over the course of their lives to remove these benign tumors to prevent, you know, damage to the organs.
It's very interesting. Just kind of, you know, looking back on treating these types of patients, can you describe maybe one of the more challenging cases that you've been presented with?
Oh, I can tell you, we had a very interesting case of a young woman. You know, she was a young adult, a mother who was known to have von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. So she was, I'm guessing, in her 20s. And she had been diagnosed because she had previously had an adrenal tumor. But during her pregnancy, she underwent routine surveillance and was found to have, you know, a very dramatically enlarged hemangioblastoma in her spinal cord, kind of in the middle part of her neck, her upper neck. And I was quite surprised to see it because she didn't really have a whole lot of symptoms, but it was quite surprising for me to see. And she ended up undergoing surgery to have this removed. And, you know, I give great credit to the neurosurgeons who did a wonderful job, but, you know, it needed to be removed during the pregnancy to prevent her from having problems with, you know, spinal cord compression. So that to me was a really dramatic presentation and one that I didn't expect, but one for which I'm very grateful that we had surveillance as an option. And while she's not a child, you know, it's still a great example of the importance of surveillance and intervention.
And so St. Jude has this VHL Alliance recognized clinical care center. So could you talk maybe a little bit about that and some of the goals of the center?
We decided this past year that we would like to make St. Jude VHL Clinical Care Center. And to be honest, this was brought to my attention by a young woman who worked at St. Jude. She actually was a patient with VHL herself, and I had never been aware of clinical care centers. So, you know, I'm deeply grateful to her for bringing this to my attention. So together with one of my genetic counselors, we put together an application to become a clinical care center. And what that really means is that we brought together all the experts who take care of patients with VHL. So for example, surgeons and neurologists and nephrologists and oncologists. And our goal is that by bringing everyone together, we could provide kind of a source of information and serve as a resource to individuals who live in the St. Jude catchment area who have VHL or, you know, might have it and need to be evaluated and monitored for it. And just to remind you, you know, the catchment area for St. Jude is about an area with a 150-mile radius around St. Jude. And many of the, you know, communities in this area are relatively underserved. So we wanted to try to make ourselves available to the families in this area and to provide expertise for any who might have VHL syndrome.
Are there any the latest efforts or ongoing work that's being done at the center right now that you think are important to highlight?
Since we're so new, you know, our initiatives are in their earliest stages. But I would say right now, there are two things that we're working on. One is surveillance. So really trying to examine the efficacy of surveillance for children with VHL. So we have a protocol, and I'm working with radiologists now to gather the data that we've collected so far with our VHL patients. You know, what have we picked up? Has the pickup been early? Has the outcome been successful? So this is more of a retrospective evaluation. The other thing that we're doing, which is not so much research, but is something aimed at providing education and support for families, is in the fall, we plan to have a virtual conference on VHL, where we will bring together experts in the field to discuss the latest advances and to provide, you know, guidance to families and teens around VHL. So we're just beginning to plan that conference. Oh, you know, it's really great. So we had, this will be our third family conference. We had one in 2018, which focused on a different condition called Leigh-Fraumeni syndrome, and then one this last fall on a condition called Dicer-1 syndrome. And these conferences are fantastic because, you know, a lot of families that are affected by these conditions, they don't know any other families, you know, and this is a chance for them to get together and to connect. It's a chance for the teens to meet other teens with the condition. And then it's a chance for, you know, us to get to know these families better, because you can only imagine when we're in clinic, right? We're constantly busy. We're thinking about moving on to the next patient. And it's so nice to have a chance to sit down and really talk to these families and try to understand, you know, what their lives are like and provide whatever support we can to them. So it's very gratifying from, you know, a personal perspective. And then it's also a great chance to learn a lot about these conditions, both from the patients and from the experts in the field. So I'd love to talk to you more about it once we have our agenda set and our, you know, information in better shape.
So these are just, is it like all the families come on and they're, and you go through different types of just like different talks and have with them, or do they all kind of like mingle with one another and share stories?
For the first meeting in 2018, it was in person, and it was wonderful. We brought in about 100 people. That was the most that we could collect or could entice to come with the Leigh-Fraumeni syndrome. So there were about 100 people from about 30 families, and they came from all over the United States. Some were St. Jude families, some were families from other institutions. And this was really a great opportunity for us all to get together. Then we had outside speakers come. We had planned an in-person meeting for 2020, and then I'm afraid the pandemic hit. So our meeting for 2020 became a virtual meeting. And to be honest with you, it had its pluses and minuses. It didn't have the same warm feeling that a get-together in person did, but it allowed us to offer it to more families. And this time we opened it to providers as well. So we had several hundred people this time attend the meeting. So there are pluses and minuses to both. And I imagine our next one in the fall, it's still a little open as to whether travel will be allowed. St. Jude, I'm not sure if they'll allow people on campus. So it may be hybrid, where there could be a small number of families that come, but it may also be in part virtual. We'll see how it goes. Right now we're planning for virtual. I think, you know, from a pediatric perspective, especially from the perspective of someone who has an underlying genetic syndrome like VHL, these are conditions that aren't going to go away. And I'm particularly interested now in trying to better support our teens and young adults as they transition from the pediatric world to the adult world. And while children are young, their parents will look after them. And, you know, us as pediatric oncologists will make sure that all the scans are done and that things are followed through. But what I've learned over time is that as patients reach 18, 19, 20, they leave the home, they're no longer under our care. They're not necessarily following through with the recommended surveillance. And so I think part of the purpose to actually start these conferences was to begin to work with the teens to teach them self-advocacy and how to follow through with making that appointment, following through with their surveillance, you know, taking their medications if needed. And we're hoping to develop a more formal transition program here for children with genetic syndromes who are going out into the adult world. And that's, it may sound simple, but it's actually a novel concept. Most cancer predisposition programs like ours are primarily focused on genetic testing, like so genetic counseling, genetic testing, and for those who test positive, doing surveillance. Right now, there aren't any really working on the transition to adult years. And so I'm hoping we can set up a real formal program and a better way to support families. And I'm hoping that that can serve as a model for other cancer predisposition programs elsewhere. So these conferences are just the very beginning of that. But I just wanted you to know about it because I think it could be a new area to emphasize for the future for cancer predisposition programs like ours.
Are there any other trials or agents that you're aware of that are under investigation that you think are good to mention?
There is a trial using a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's called pazotinib. So it's a pan-tyrosine kinase inhibitor that inhibits a number of proteins, one of which is the VEGF receptor, so the vascular endothelial growth factor receptor. And as I noted earlier, a lot of the tumors, particularly these hemangioblastomas, but I think also the renal cell carcinomas in patients with VHL are very vascular tumors. So any drugs that can interfere with or reduce blood vessel formation have potential to be of benefit in patients with VHL. So this pazotinib is another drug that I know is under study for patients.
Finally, what are maybe a must-know thing for people who really aren't familiar with VHL? What do you think is really like the take-home of what people need to be aware of with this condition?
I think that there are two take-home messages, and one of them is to become familiar with the VHL Alliance. This is a tremendous organization that has generated incredible resources for patients and families, and they serve as a resource to clinical care centers just like ours and others. So I think people should feel free to visit the VHLA website and to contact the individuals that work there. They're a phenomenal resource. And then the other is, I think that it's really important that people recognize the importance of monitoring, to follow through with surveillance, but also not to let that dictate their lives. So this is going to seem complicated. So this, you know, patients with VHL are no different than anyone else. They may have to have additional tests. It's all meant to keep them healthy. And it's a very important thing to do, but really don't let it consume your life or cause great anxiety, because I think ultimately the outcomes are excellent. It's just, you have to be a little bit more careful about caring for yourself.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit OncLive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.